Chapter 19, Preservation and Forfeiture of the Loot of Corruption. There can be little doubt that an effective means of countering corruption is to create systems designed to bring about the forfeiture of the loot of corruption by those involved and their fellow travellers. A greater disincentive is hard to imagine. The use of civil proceedings, in which the onus of proof is lighter, to rake back the proceeds of corruption is a form of restorative justice that is particularly applicable in situations in which the victims of the crime, usually the poor and disadvantaged in society, are not even aware of the commission of the crime of corruption, nor of the adverse impact of the looting involved in the diverting of public funds to the private interests of the corrupt. It is appropriate in the post-pandemic world to give particular attention to the efficacy of existing machinery and to consider upgrades where indicated. If an international anti-corruption court is established, it will have jurisdiction to freeze, seize, declare forfeit, and return the proceeds of grand corruption to the victims of grand corruption. The civil recovery of the proceeds of corruption requires that the state or state-owned enterprises that are nominal victim of the corruption can generate the will to take up the cudgels against the corrupt. This is sometimes, if not often, difficult to do because the corrupt are influential people who all too frequently have control of the criminal justice administration in the countries in which they perpetrate their corrupt activities. Officials whose duty it is to protect the public purse come under pressure due to fear of retaliation by the corrupt and apprehension that friends of the corrupt will sabotage efforts to recover loot. The creation of international jurisdiction for preservation and forfeiture processes would help solve these practical problems. The simplicity of a civil freezing order, in terms of which the proceeds of the crime of corruption are identified, seized, and held pending the determination of the civil or criminal proceedings against the corrupt, is attractive and indeed only possible once the location of the misappropriated loot is determined. Modern forensic accounting practices and the automation of the banking systems of the world make it considerably easier, using artificial intelligence, to track the loot through the various, sometimes dodgy, jurisdictions in which it is hidden away from law enforcers. At the urgings of Eddie Cross, the inimitable Zimbabwean opposition politician, as he then was, the Boksburg Declaration, which is quoted in full in the second appendix of this book, includes as Resolution 6, the international community of nations must use its capacity to monitor and investigate global financial movements via the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, SWIFT, as a means for identifying illegal movements of funds implicated in corrupt activities around the world. This capacity must be used to secure the prosecution of individuals and companies who are involved in corruption. Every effort must be made to recover funds which are the product of corrupt activities and to return these funds to the lawful authorities in their countries of origin. The legal machinery for what are called anti-dissipation orders exists in most jurisdictions and can, given the necessary political will, easily be legislated in the jurisdictions that do not yet have the laws to enable the courts to grant the anti-dissipation relief. One of the great advantages of persuading a court to grant an anti-dissipation order is that the seizure of the assets or the freezing of the account concerned can only be ended by a court order reversing the freezing order. This step can only be taken by putting up a convincing explanation for the presence of the loot in the account in question. Often, the looters, caught with the freezing order, granted without notice to them, decide that discretion dictates that they not oppose the freezing order. To do so usually involves an explanation that has to seek to excuse obvious criminality. Making an affidavit to try to do so can involve its deponent in further trouble relating to the falsity of the affidavit. So the freezing order goes unchallenged, and in due course, in unopposed proceedings, it is converted into an order forfeiting the frozen funds or assets to the rightful owner, who has used the courts to assert the right of ownership. An advantage of civil freezing orders is that there is no great delay involved in obtaining such an order ex parte, which means without notice to the respondent looter. Once the facts are marshalled, the loot is traced to an identifiable place or account, and service of court papers is executed. The application is served on the court first, and only after the freezing order is granted is it served on the respondent, account, or asset holder. This procedure is followed to obviate the subject matter of the order being hidden or moved away before service of the order attaching same is granted. Experience in the field is that all too often the respondents in applications of this kind realize that their game is up when the freezing order is granted. They make no effort to oppose the court proceedings and allow the follow-up forfeiture proceedings to be taken to final judgment by default. Some victims of freezing orders, like Isabel dos Santos, discussed and quoted in the previous chapter of this book, do not go down without a fight. That fight is made difficult if the freezing order stays in place while the parties contest the right of the applicant to the relief obtained without notice to the respondent. Forensic accountants who specialize in the obtaining of freezing orders, technically called an attachment of assets pending final judgment, are able to use the SWIFT banking system to trace the loot every step of the way to the account or place in which it is found. If looted funds have been used to buy an asset, then it is also possible to freeze the asset acquired in this way. In criminal proceedings, most jurisdictions allow a court at sentencing stage of proceedings to order the convicted accused to refund the loot in corruption cases. If the loot is well hidden or has been dissipated by the accused, then the utility of such an order is questionable. In order to obviate an empty order to pay back the money stolen, the criminal law has been developed by legislatures in advanced jurisdictions to allow for an assets forfeiture unit in the Criminal Justice Administration to seek a civil attachment order in criminal proceedings, which has the effect of freezing the loot in question until the criminal trial is ended, at which stage the fate of the loot is the subject of the court's order in the matter. The proceeds of crime can be returned to the rightful owner in this way, and it is also possible to seek forfeiture of assets used as the instrumentality of the crime. So, for example, a house used as an illegal drug-making laboratory to manufacture recreational drugs may be forfeited to the state as part of the penalty paid by the convicted accused persons who operated from and owned that house. An advantage of this type of procedure in criminal cases is that the cooperation of the common victims of corruption, usually nominally a state department or state-owned enterprise, is not required. The decision-making in the case is in the hands of the prosecution service, not the victims of the looting. The reason for the advantage is that it enables the state to use its anti-corruption machinery to recover assets looted without any buy-in from the Department of State or state-owned enterprise that has been looted. This is significant in South Africa, where the Zondo Commission of Inquiry into State Capture has heard a great deal of evidence of looting that has not been acted on by those looted. An alternative way of tackling this problem is to cede the claims to loot to a special purpose vehicle in the form of a company that specializes in debt recovery of this kind. In corruption cases, it is usually sufficient to recover the loot, but some asset forfeiture units do seek to take matters further than that. In a case against the operator of an illegal casino, the Constitutional Court in South Africa, reversing a decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal, declined a request that a factory building in which the casino was operated be forfeited. This is how the case is summed up in the South African Law Report's headnote. Statutory civil forfeiture of assets is meant to pursue worthy and noble objectives aimed at curbing serious crime. And yet, there is no gainsaying that, in effect, it is draconian. It is premised on the notion that it is a civil remedy and that the prosecution or state has to show only on a balance of probabilities that the property may be seized and forfeited to the state. The criminal standard of proof does not come into it. When the state seeks civil forfeiture of assets that were used in the commission of a crime, it is not required to show that the owner has been convicted of the offence or that the owner performed an unlawful act with a criminal intent. The initial and central inquiry in assets forfeiture is whether a property is an instrumentality of an offence. If it is, the property is liable to be declared forfeit to the state. In principle, the closer the criminal activities are to the primary objective of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, the more readily should a court grant a forfeiture order. Conversely, the more remote the activities are from these objectives, the more compelling must the circumstances be to make such an order appropriate. Furthermore, any determination of proportionality should take into account the extent to which the common law and statutes prove or threaten to be inadequate in the circumstances. While the primary purpose of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act in relation to the instrumentality of an offence is to deter people from using property for crime, that purpose cannot legitimize the forfeiture of every instrumentality of an offence. Deterrence as a law enforcement objective is constrained by the principle that individuals may not be used in an instrumental manner as examples to others if deterrence is set at levels beyond what is fair and just to those individuals. To do otherwise would be to breach the constitutional principle of dignity. In each case, therefore, care needs to be taken to ensure that the purpose of deterrence that the legislation serves do not produce a disproportionate impact on the owner of the forfeited property. It is for this reason that the deterrent purpose of the legislation must be weighed against the effect on the individual owner in light of the relevant offence. In this respect, the extent to which the forfeiture manifestly is directed towards preventing organised crime will be highly relevant. The disjuncture between the basic purpose of the Prevention of Organised Crime Act and the effect on the individual concerned should never be too great. The first applicant, through the second applicant, Shellgate Investment, of whom he was the sole member, ran an unlicensed gambling operation in contravention of the KwaZulu-Natal Gambling Act on certain premises subsequently forfeited under the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. The premises were used for both illegal trade and for operating gambling machines without a license, an illegal trade under the Gambling Act. The first applicant was arrested and charged under that act, pleaded guilty, and paid an admission of guilt fine. Further, his gaming machines were seized and destroyed. The National Director of Public Prosecutions subsequently launched proceedings for civil forfeiture in respect of the premises. In the Constitutional Court, the applicants sought leave to appeal against the decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal, upholding an appeal against a High Court decision and replacing it with one declaring the immovable property belonging to the second applicant forfeit to the state in terms of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, on the grounds that it was an instrumentality of an offence. The issues that fell to be decided were A, whether the property concerned was an instrumentality of an offence, B, the meaning of offence in the context of civil forfeiture authorised by Chapter 6 of the Act, and C, whether the forfeiture sought was disproportionate. There was no dispute regarding A, but the court disagreed as to whether such forfeiture was disproportionate. On the facts, the majority held that it was. Accordingly, the appeal was upheld, and the order of the Supreme Court of Appeal was replaced with one dismissing the application. The decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal in National Director of Public Prosecutions versus Muhonoran and others was set aside and substituted. The SWIFT banking system and other similar systems around the world are underutilized as a means of tracking, freezing, and obtaining the return of proceeds of grand corruption. The reasons for this are usually a combination of lack of political will to follow up on loot and a paucity of laws that can be enforced by skilled specialists in the recovery of the loot of grand corruption. The United Nations will be giving consideration to solving these shortcomings in the system when it holds its special session on corruption in June 2021. The emergency procurements necessitated by the pandemic are a vast breeding ground for corruption in procurement. This unfortunate state of affairs ought to spur the UN in its deliberations.